You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
People keep asking, are we back? Yeah, I guess we're back. Back to talk about cigars, movies, TV shows, and any other nerdy topics here on the Cigar Nerds Podcast. Check us out on CigarNerdPodcast.com and ESONetwork.com. And we have a YouTube channel at Cigar Nerd Podcast, where we do cigar reviews, live versions of the show, and any other dumb thing we think to record.
Evidently, you do not realize you are in an interstellar conveyance. You are already outside the atmosphere of your own planet.
Monster attack! Monster attack! Monster attack! Monster attack!
Hey everybody, welcome to this week's episode of Monster Attack, the podcast dedicated to old monster movies. And we have got an extraordinary film, and I think that that's a word that may not even be good enough to describe this motion picture and the impact it had on me when it first came out. But I will say an extraordinary film. Ray Bradbury called it one of the best science fictions, if not the best science fiction films ever made. And I think there's a couple that have jumped into that category since Bradbury made that statement. But I got to tell you, folks, this is a film that will always be in my top five of all-time films, not just science fiction films, and one that will always have an extremely special place in my heart. Now, I want to apologize right off the bat. I'm going to be a little raspy. Voice is going to be a little in a little rough shape today. I'm getting over a very bad head cold. Can you believe it? After a 2-year pandemic that affected us worldwide. And then, I haven't had a head cold in like 20 some years, but got tagged somehow from somewhere. So I'm just now getting my voice back after about 5 days without, having horrible laryngitis. So, indulge me, but, I wanted to talk so much about this film. And I've got to confess that this is not the film. And should I tell you what it is? Of course I should. It's Close Encounters of a Third Kind by Steven Spielberg. An amazing film. Okay. I was originally going to do this film at this time, but something that I mentioned in last week's episode of Hangar 18, I made mention of this film, and I couldn't get it out of my mind. And it just kept bugging me and bugging me and bugging me. And then I was looking for something to watch when I was sick. And all of a sudden, the 4K version of this film popped up. And it was the collector's edition, or what many people call the director's cut, the final edition. We're going to be talking about all the different types of reissues that appeared for Close Encounters, because we'll be basically talking about three main films: the original release, and then the special edition, and then what is now known as the director's cut. And if you stream Close Encounters, more than likely you're going to find the director's cut first. And this is the one that, since about 2001, has played on like AMC. AMC ran it quite a bit. It's the one that includes the press conference scene. And we're going to get into all of the different all the differences between the different editions and why there were so many different editions. It wasn't all Steven Spielberg's fault. So anyway, I wasn't going to do this originally. And then I couldn't help myself. I got so psyched sitting down and watching this film again. I said, I've just got to talk about it right now. I could not shake it from my excitement. The one thing about Close Encounters of a Third Kind is that if you don't walk out of the theater, if you see this in a big theater, this is one of those films I wish they would, reissue, in a big picture, in a big theater, like they've been doing so many nostalgia films recently, because this one is just amazing on the big screen. But if you don't walk out of the theater or wrap up watching this at home on a big screen, not feeling exhilarated, not feeling positive, then I don't think you're human. You know, in this time of negativity and all of the political turmoil that's going on and stuff, and here we go, the politics are working itself into the show again. And I apologize for that. But, you know, we've gone through so much negativity recently in these last 3 or 4 years, fighting with one another, the partisanship that's going on, you know, people not getting along with each other, you know, and it's my way or the highway and all of this stuff. We need a film like this. We really need a film like this. I could not believe how much I was picked up watching Close Encounters this last time out a few days ago. And I'm going to make it a point of watching this film more than once a year, at least 3 or 4 times a year, just for that experience. This is one of Steven Spielberg's greatest films. Now, people are going to say, Jim, hey, you know, what about Schindler's List and all that? Saving Private Ryan, all brilliant films. But there is something about this one that just really stands out for me. And this is a personal opinion. You know, I first saw Steven Spielberg's work in college, a little made-for-TV film called Duel with Dennis Weaver. And it became one of the most popular TV movies that I saw while I was in college. The whole dorm loved the film. And even kids who weren't into those kind of movies or into monster movies or horror films or whatever just loved that movie. So when I saw that Steven Spielberg was going to be doing Jaws, which I got very excited about, and of course I was still in school, and when that came out, all of a sudden it was like I became a big Steven Spielberg fan. And for those of you that were alive back when this film was in development, I mean, it's really, you know, we've had some incredible films come out over the years that just took on a life of their own. And Close Encounters was one of those. Because Spielberg was so close to the vest, I was like heavily into, as I told you last week, UFO stuff and reading up as much of it as I could, you know, all of the sightings, theories, and all that. And like I said, I didn't get fanatical about the conspiracy stuff, but I, like many people, felt that we weren't being told the whole story by the government. And we're finding out now, like I said last week, that we really weren't, you know, there, and it was more, I believe now, nothing sinister, but more they were trying to protect us. They were so fearful of what people would think and what society would think if they discovered, you know, actually evidence of life on another planet or whatever, you know, alien life. So when I heard that Spielberg was going to be doing a movie about UFOs, and that's basically all that was being said about it, I was really psyched. I thought, man, this is the guy that did Jaws. This is going to be a terrific film. I cannot wait to see what he does with this subject. This is going to be something else. And not much came out about it. We knew nothing about the storyline. And again, I wonder if Spielberg would have been able to do this in the days of internet now, because there's so many people out there, you know, that one guy or the group of people that have to spoil things for people. You know, the people we're talking about, they're miserable people that hate their lives. And so they want to, you know, they want to bring everyone down with them. And they go out of their way to try to spoil movies for people movies that shouldn't have been spoiled. You know, if you don't get the full effect. And you know, I hate people like that. I really do. But I think he was able to keep this very, very quiet. I mean, the security on this, the production of this film was unbelievable. Now, the film was produced by Columbia Films. And at the time, and a lot of people may not know this, at the time, Columbia was going through some real heavy financial problems. They were putting all their cards on Steven Spielberg. You know, based on what he had done with Jaws, they said, we need a hit. Now, we need a big, big hit. And they felt that Spielberg would be able to do that for them, and they gambled correctly, because this film was a huge hit when it came out. And ironically, it was not Spielberg's favorite film. When it came out, he felt like he could have done better. He was very, very upset with how the film turned out. And it wasn't his fault, but he had originally wanted to release this film a little later than it was released, but Columbia was, like I said, folks, to say they were in financial difficulties probably doesn't say it well enough, but they were hurting. They were really hurting at this time and needed something to happen quickly. So they rushed him, and they said, no, this has got to be released in December of 1977. At this time, I was out of school. I was living in Rome, Georgia at the time. My first stint in Georgia, and my folks had moved down there while I was in college. So I was getting started down in Rome, Georgia, working for a 7-Eleven of all places. And so I saw this film there by myself, and I was just absolutely blown away. Just blown away. I'm going to be bouncing all over the place on this one, folks, by the way. There's so many visions that come into my head, so many flashbacks of that first experience. This film, walking into it, the only other film I can think of that I saw in the same kind of attitude was The Omen, which was very secretive. All it was was a black poster with the name The Omen on it. And nobody knew what the film was until we actually went and saw it. And that one blew me away because of the subject matter. This one was the same thing. I knew it was going to be about UFOs. I knew it was going to be about people finding out about UFOs being real and, that there was life and all that. But that's it. Didn't know anything about the storyline at all. It was on a $19.4 million budget, which for 1977, pretty good budget. And it had a really good cast. Richard Dreyfuss was carried over from Jaws. He wasn't Spielberg's original choice. Spielberg looked at a number of different people to play Roy Neary, who was our lead in this film. And we're going to be talking about a few of the actors as we go along here, because the film really centers around about four or five people. It really is, in a sense, as far as your major cast, a small cast, but you see a lot of people all throughout. I mean, so it's a big epic type film. But Dreyfuss was championing hard when he heard that Spielberg was going to make this movie during the filming of Jaws. And they became good friends. And finally, Spielberg realized, there's something about Richard Dreyfuss and the way he does his characters that I think would work for the character of Roy Neary. And he was perfect. I can't imagine anyone else doing this. He was perfect in that role. He's joined by Terry Garr, who plays his hapless wife. And, Terry, very, very pretty, just very, very much the girl next door type. And again, Steven Spielberg knew how to capture the essence of suburbia in America. And he does that here so well. This is the kind of thing we would see in other films of his, because he brings so many personal experiences into his filmmaking. And that is one thing that I think makes Spielberg probably one of the greatest directors we've ever seen in my lifetime. And I know a lot of people would argue with me on that. Guys, if you know my list of who I think are the best directors in the world during my lifetime, Spielberg's on that list, but so are many, many others, like Stanley Kubrick and Robert Altman and others like that. So he keeps good company in my book. But he could encapsulate that feeling of suburbia so well. And it plays big into this, because Richard Dreyfuss's character, Roy Neary, works for the power company. He's a lineman. He goes out and, when there's power outages and stuff, he goes out in the truck and he's the guy that, gets up onto the power pole and resets the transformer or whatever, that sort of thing. Every day, blue collar working Joe. And they have a bunch of kids. They have four kids. I think the oldest one is probably about like 12 years old. All of the problems, you would have raising that many kids. He's into model trains. He's got a big model train set up in his family room. You know, and it's a nice touch of how Spielberg introduces you to this family very quickly in the beginning of this film. And they're just regular, ordinary people, you know, trying to pay their bills, their mortgage, you know, raise their kids and be good parents. And Terry Garr is your, back then, your stereotypical housewife. And Roy is called out late at night when there's a major blackout. And again, folks, I can't tell you enough about how this film was shot, the look of it, the cinematographer, Vilas Zsigmond, as close as I can get to his name, but he'd worked with him on Jaws as well. And this film looks incredible. Absolutely incredible. Now Spielberg did want to shoot most of this on a soundstage. And he does. But then he broke down and realized he had to take some of it out on location. So the suburbia scenes are done on location. And the scenes at the end are done on location as well. They also got use of an old Air Force base and stuff. So there's a few location shots here. But for the most part, everything else you see on this is a soundstage. And they're beautiful stages. Just beautiful, incredible sound stages. By the way, folks, how many of you out there have not seen this film? I am guessing that most of you have probably seen one or a couple of the versions of this film. But just in case, I will quickly say that everything will get spoiled in this. Because you can't talk about this film without spoiling this movie. Okay. That said, before we get back to Roy Neary and his experience with these aliens in this movie, Spielberg gets you on the hook right at the very beginning, because the movie opens up in the desert, and this is where we meet one of the more incredible casting choices that Spielberg made in the film, and that's Francois Truffaut. And he wasn't sure if he wanted to be in a movie or not. This would be the only movie he would appear in as an actor that he didn't direct, but he says a lot about the experience he had there, and he is very complimentary about how Steven Spielberg directed this film. Coming from a director like Truffaut, that says a lot. A lot. We don't really know who he is. But he's part of some kind of group or organization, which we later find out is a UN-based organization. Group of scientists who are exploring strange occurrences. This setup in the very beginning, it's in the middle of a dust storm. They find these planes. They're World War II issue planes, fighters. And immediately the UFO in me goes, oh my God, that's Flight 19. I'll never forget that. I mean, you know, there was a lot of us in the theater that day that I saw this. I saw it on the first weekend of release. I could not wait to see this movie. And there were a lot, I could hear the rumblings in the theaters, like, yeah, Flight 19. So there were a lot of us who were into UFOs who knew exactly what was going on here. And they find these planes, and they verify them by the serial numbers, and they start up just like they're brand new. Because we're introduced to a character that Bob Balaban plays. He's brought in as a translator for Francois Truffaut's character. So he's a French-speaking guy, but we find out he's a cartographer, reads maps, which will come into play later on in the story. He can't understand what's going on. They talk to this elderly Mexican guy who's sitting by his house out on the porch, and he's sunburned, and he's just smiling, and he tells them that the sun showed up last night and was singing. We don't really know what all that means, but they do tell us Flight 19. Now, for those of you who don't know about Flight 19, that is a training mission that disappeared in the Bermuda Triangle back in 1945. I always want to bring that Roswell thing in, don't I? So that gets it started. And then we've got all of these little occurrences. This major blackout. And while Richard Dreyfuss, and again, I'm going to skip over some stuff, folks. I'm not going to give you every instance, but the ones that just really, really tagged me. where he's out there on the road and he can't tell where he is. Again, we don't have GPS. No cell phones. He's got all these maps trying to figure out where he is. And of course, he's out in the middle of nowhere. There's no lights. It's pitch black. He's hopelessly lost. And he has an experience. Here's some weird noises going on. He looks over where there's a row of mailboxes that are going nuts. And again, I didn't quite make the connection on this when I first saw this. But then it occurred to me, magnetism. Because, you know, one of the prevalent theories in 1977, and still today, is the propulsion systems involve some kind of electromagnetic propulsion. And then this huge light bathes the truck that he's in, and things just start going nuts. It's almost like everything's weightless. And again, this is the magnetism effect. And they did that by putting the truck on a rotating type of rod. So they literally, when your Dreyfus is in the truck, they're literally rotating him 360 degrees. And he said that it was a frightening scene for him. So a lot of what you see is not acting, but he's really reacting to, because he had no idea what it was going to be like, what the effect was going to be like. It's like the ultimate amusement park ride. But we see something go overhead. Now, it's pitch black, but you can just see a couple little lights. You can tell this thing is pretty big. And then he sees it down the road, lighting up the next intersection. And he starts chasing it. This leads to an incredible chase scene. Now, while this is all going on, we're bouncing back and forth to another scene with an actress by the name of Melinda Dillon, who plays a character by the name of Jillian, single mother. We assume single mother. She's got this nice farmhouse. This is all in Illinois. This is all taking place in Illinois. Raising her young son, who's probably about 3 years old, I would guess. Played by an amazing actor, Carrie Guffey. And I want to talk a minute about Carrie Guffey, because Carrie is one that he's one of those head scratchers that he should have had an unbelievably long career in acting. Steven Spielberg called this kid one of the most natural actors he ever worked with, at child actors. He would do things in one or two takes, which is amazing. In fact, Spielberg was so entranced with Carrie Guffey, and they're still good friends, that he had a t-shirt made during the production that, you know, he called him One Take Carrie, and he handed out to the cast and the crew. The crew loved him. The cast loved working with him. And the kid almost steals the movie with some of his reactions, because he sees the UFO. And they seem to be attracted to him. And he goes running off in the middle of the night. Jillian wakes up and she hears him out in the yard and sees him go running off into the woods, and she goes racing after him. So while Roy Neary is chasing after these UFOs, we've got Jillian chasing Barry, her little kid, in the woods, trying to figure out what the heck's he doing. And we're trying to figure out what's going on here. And it takes us to this country road where all these people are. They're just sitting there. Nobody knows what they're doing. Now, Carrie shows up, I'm going to call him by his character name. Barry shows up, standing in the middle of the road looking for something. And Roy Neary nearly hits him with the truck that he's driving. So that introduces us now. We get these two guys introduced. We get Roy introduced to Jillian and Barry. And we see all these weird people. It's like some kind of social event. And then all of a sudden, here come the UFOs. And they're little ones. They come flying around the corner and up the road. And they are being pursued by three police cars. And Roy jumps back into his truck and he follows them too. It takes them through the toll booth on the border between Illinois and Indiana. So now they go flying into Indiana. Of course, the guy at the toll booth, it's a great scene where all of a sudden all the bars raise up on their own. The guy can't figure out what's going on. And all of a sudden these three UFOs, actually it's four of them, because there's a little red light that goes following them, goes flying through there. And then all of a sudden these three cops and then this truck. And he's like, hey, wait a minute. This is Indiana. Wait, hold on. You know, he wants his, you know, you got to pay your toll. And one of the cop cars is so focused on these UFOs, they go flying out over this field and up into the sky, that he loses control of his car and goes flying through this guardrail out into the field. Now, the stunt people that actually drove that car had a mishap. They were just supposed to, slam on the brakes and sort of skid into the guardrail, slam into this guardrail. But something went wrong, and the stunt guy ended up smashing through the guardrail out into the field. So, you know, a very hard landing. He got a little banged up. He'd spent a few nights in the hospital. But it's just a great scene. There are nothing but great scenes in this movie. I can't get over how much fun this film was. Every time I've seen it. It's one of those films you can watch over and over and over again and never get tired of. I don't know. Some people might, but guys like me don't. So now Dreyfuss's character, Roy, runs home. It's like 4 o'clock in the morning. He wakes everybody up, wakes up Bobby, his wife, and all the kids, and says, come on, I got to go show you this. And he drags them all out there where all these people were, hoping that the UFOs would come back. And now, you know, we get a little sense that Bobby is a little concerned about her husband, but she's going to play along with it. And this sets the stage for a sub-story that involves, you know, the big sub-story that drives this film. Roy Neary's obsession with his UFOs. He starts cutting out newspaper stories. Of course, Bobby's trying to hide them from him because she's afraid this is getting too ridiculous. We find out Roy gets fired from his job. And from the conversation that she has with his boss, who doesn't even want to talk to him, we get the impression that they thought he was drunk or something like that, and they just got rid of him. So Roy's out of work, but he's totally obsessed with UFOs. Now, while this is all going on, we got all these little side stories happening. One scene that was added back into the special edition, it wasn't in the first showing. I wish it had been, because I remember when I went and saw the special edition. So I'm going to be telling you about two different viewings here. Because in 1980, when the special edition was released, there was a bunch of us that had to go see it because of the way it was marketed. And I'm going to tell you about that in just a minute. But we knew there was going to be extra footage. This is where Columbia wanted to capitalize on the popularity of the film and try to make some more money off of it. And placate Steven Spielberg a little bit, who went to them and said, hey, I want to redo some of this. I didn't like the way it was done. It's not my best work. I can make it better. And in some ways he did. But it's a scene that it takes place in the Gobi Desert, and all of a sudden these UN trucks, or I should say SUVs or whatever, SUVs at that time, come flying over the sand dune, and all of a sudden they stop, and everyone gets out, and they're absolutely stunned, and there's a huge freighter. And I'm talking about a freighter boat sitting in the middle of the Gobi Desert. The way this is shot, again, Zsigmond does such an incredible job shooting this thing. I mean, he really makes this film. Cinematography is brilliant. The way the slow pan, you're not really sure, well, what are they looking at? What is that? Figure maybe it's going to be some more airplanes or something, and then you see this boat, this ship. It's mind-blowing. So on the second showing, where I saw this film, you know, when I watched the special edition, that blew my mind. We've got all these events going on. Another one that involves, that was in both issues, India. And of course, here's the UN folks are, you know, they're following all of these leads because they know something's going on, trying to figure out why is all this happening all of a sudden. It's a huge throng of people in India. They're following this, I would call him a guru. I don't know what else to call him. Some kind of religious figure or political figure, probably a little of both. And Truffaut's character, who's we sort of now have discerned is sort of the lead investigator on this thing, says, ask them. You know, they're singing this weird song or this weird tune five notes. Dun, 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 dun. It's as best as I can do. You're going to hear this all throughout. And by the way, little Barry plays it on his little xylophone, his little toy xylophone at home. Because we jump back and forth to Barry, too, on this. And these people are, you know, they're singing these notes. So the guy asks the guru, he says, ask them, where did the music come from? And this is one of the best scenes in the whole movie. Well, there's a bunch of them, but this one's right up there. The guru is standing up on a little cliff, looking down on this throng of people. I mean, there's thousands of people. The shot is coming from their point of view, shooting over the tops of their heads. So you don't see them in this shot. And I don't know Indian. I don't know Hindu or whatever. But clearly he's saying, where did the sound come from? And then all of these hands go flying up. That's all you see in the scene is these hands with the index finger extended. Like number one, saying that it came from the sky. And then that takes us to a symposium. Now we've got all these guys. We've got, you know, Truffaut's character and all the people, you know, Bob Balaban's character and these people we've been introduced to that we know are some kind of research scientists. And they're putting it all together saying, hey, this is a response to, this is the tone we find out that has been sent out into outer space as part of what now is known as SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And this is the response they're getting back, this stuff happening. And a tone comes back to them. Now, the computers in 1977 were not even as powerful as what we've got in our phones nowadays. They take up whole rooms and stuff, but they still, you know, they were still pretty helpful. And they realized that whatever this signal is, it's a bunch of numbers. It's two series of six numbers. It just keeps repeating over and over and over again. And Bob Balaban's character says, you know, before I was hired to speak French, I read maps. And this first number is a longitude. So that, you know, there's some humor that's worked into this, where they break into this office that has this big globe. And the guy goes, hey, wait a minute, this is like a $5,500 globe here. But they got to have a globe to track down the latitudes and the longitude, the latitude and the longitude. And all we know at this point is that it's in Wyoming. The coordinate is in Wyoming. Now, there's a lot going on between all these. I mean, what I love about what Spielberg does is he intertwines all of the action. So all of these things are happening simultaneously. This movie runs 2 hours and 18 minutes, and you would never know it. You would never know it. It does not feel like a 2 hour and 18 minute movie. It just takes you on it's almost like riding a ride in an amusement park. So a sub story that's going on while this is all going on is Roy Neary and this impact that he's had. He's gone, he goes back out by himself to the place where they saw the UFOs before, and all the people are back out there again. He meets up with Jillian and Barry, and little hints that we've been getting up until this point is that there's something in his mind he can't explain. A figure. And the little kid is making something, you know, like a sand, I don't want to say a sandcastle, but out of the dirt, he's making something. And Dreyfus, without even saying anything, starts helping him. And so does Bobby. Jillian, sorry, Bobby's not there. And he says, I can't explain it. I've been seeing this in my head. And she says, yeah, I have too. She says, I've got sketches at my house of the sea. I don't know what it is either. He sculpts it. There's some humorous scenes where at the dinner scene, he's eating mashed potatoes, and all of a sudden he piles them on his plate and he tries to make this geographical figure. And it's driving him nuts. He says, I don't get this. I don't know what's going on. It's driving me crazy. I keep seeing it. I know it's something. I know it's important, but I don't know what it is. And that's going to lead up to one of the most epic scenes in this whole movie. And that's when the UFO returns to Barry's home. It is frightening. And Jillian is trying to lock them in where it can't get to it. And, you know, and of course, Barry's like, oh, come on in, come on in. You know, he's all excited. And they end up abducting him. I can't even do justice to how incredibly intense that scene is. But even having seen it so many times over, it's still an intense scene to think of what it must have been like for a single mother whose three-year-old son is being literally pulled away from her by something she can't see, just a bunch of lights and smoke. And it's an incredible scene. Steven Spielberg said that there was a shot, a publicity shot, after the film was released, and now the secret's out, of Barry standing at his front door, the front door of his house. It's open, bathed in an orange light. And he said that was the most iconic picture from the movie and his favorite scene from the movie. Watch for the Facebook page and the classic Movie Monsters page and stuff, because I'm going to go ahead and post that later on during the week here after this episode's released. You'll know what I'm talking about. It's a classic, classic scene. So now Jillian has lost her child. Now, this is a scene that I can't remember if it was in the original or not. It wasn't in the it was cut from the special edition and then added back in on the director's cut. And it was a press conference with the Air Force. And for the life of me, I've racked my brain trying to think if that was in the original release or not, because you can't find the original release anymore. It's nowhere to be found. You know, and again, you know, Spielberg wasn't happy with it, so he doesn't care that that one's not available. But it was it's a press conference that Neary is there with Bobby and the kids. And of course, he sees Jillian there because she's gone to the press saying that aliens stole my child. This UFO shows up and they steal my child. I saw him fly off. And they're trying to poo-poo it, you know, play it down. Then, of course, during the press conference, we see a lot of the people that we saw out on the road that night watching all the UFOs. One of them is this old guy who says, "Well, I saw Bigfoot once," and it's like, "Oh my God," you know. And you can see it on Neary's face. It's like, "God, oh, why did he show up?" Now nobody's going to take it seriously. Now I should mention the second time that Neary goes out. And he meets up with Jillian and Barry, and this is before Barry gets abducted. And all the folks are out there. They see lights, and they think, here they come again. And it ends up being a bunch of helicopters trying to scare them off, the government helicopters. They're unmarked black helicopters, but we know what that is. We've seen enough Men in Black movies to know what that is. So Barry is gone, and this leads to a wonderful scene that is back in the director's cut. It was cut considerably from the special edition in 1980. And it was one of the few disappointments I had with that edition. But it was in the original one where Roy just goes nuts. You know, he decides, okay, he has a big blowout with Bobby. His wife says, look, you know, you're out of work. You don't care. You're just obsessed with it. And he realizes, okay, I got to give this up. I'm losing my family. I'm losing everything. Lost my job. Going to lose my kids. So he's yelling out to Bobby. Says, look, hey, it's all coming down. He starts taking down all the things. Now, he's been trying to make this image out of clay on his train table. And so we see this thing, you know, just rising up. And he's trying to pull the clay off the table. And the thing breaks in half. And all of a sudden, he stops. And you see the wheels turning. And you see the look in his eye, and he realizes that's what I've been trying to make. Here it is. And he goes crazy, absolutely crazy, because now he knows, you know, he's had this image in his mind, but he couldn't quite get it right. And now he sees it the way it is. You know, maybe he was making it too long and thin or whatever, but now he sees it and he gets inspired and he starts. It's a wonderful scene. It is hilarious. He's out there. He's filled up a wheelbarrow with dirt. He's throwing dirt into the kitchen window, into the sink. He's throwing in bushes. And of course, one of the littler kids is helping. I was just, hey, I'll throw this in too. And bricks. He's getting these little garden fences type things. He goes next door where his neighbor has a bunch of chicken wire. He says, I'll pay you for it, but I need this right now. And Bobby has had it. That's it. Nope. No more. She's at the end of her rope. She's not even dressed yet, you know, because this is like early Saturday morning. She gets all the kids, throws them in the car, and just says, I'm out of here. I'm going to my sister's. It is an iconic scene where, you know, Dreyfus, then of course all the neighbors are looking because it's a big scene. And he just slowly walks back up his driveway. Of course, the window to the kitchen is open. And instead of going in the door, he just dives into the window and does whatever it is he's going to do. And then, as we find out, he's made like not a life-size model of this thing, but a huge, he's taken up his whole living room making what we later find out is the Devil's Tower. Something that looks like the Devil's Tower in great detail. And he's looking at it and he's trying to figure out, okay, now why is this important? What does this mean? And this is another wonderful scene that Spielberg puts together. He's got the TV on. There's a soap opera going in the background. You see this huge thing. And again, this is the cinematography on this. When we realize what he's making in his house, when they reveal this big thing, this big sculpture in the middle of his living room, it's wonderful. And this news story comes on. ABC News about an accident that has released some nerve gas or something. They've got to clear the area around the Devil's Tower in Wyoming. They're showing the picture of Devil's Tower, and Neary is on the phone talking to Bobby, saying, "Look, I'll go to do counseling, whatever you want to do. You know, I want you guys back. I want this to be over." You know, and he's pretty much given up the ghost, and he hangs up the phone, and it looks like maybe they're going to be able to reconcile. Then he catches wind of it on the TV, this picture of the Devil's Tower, and all of a sudden, now he knows the connection. That's why this is important. He needs to go to the Devil's Tower, even though the government's saying, stay away from there. You know, this nerve gas has gotten loose. And of course, then, now, this is like the final half hour of the film. And this was the part of the film that Spielberg, when he recut it for the director's cut, said it was the most difficult part of the film to cut. But he and the editor, they do a magnificent job. All versions of this are really good. Where he meets up with Jillian out there because she's looking for Barry. And she saw the news story. So she realized, and there's other people that saw the news story. And just skipping right ahead, they're all captured by the government. You know, the military's out there, you know, cordoning the place off. They can't understand why these people are trying to break in where, you know, there's dead animals all over the place. They're not dead, though. But we find out they're just asleep. It's a neurotoxin that just puts people to sleep. And then Neary meets Francois Truffaut's character, he and Bob Balaban's character. Because they want to know, why are you here? Asking him all this question. He's like, who are you people? What's going on here? And they show him some sketches that people have made. Some of them are probably Jillian's, because we find out that she was an artist as well, and she sketched the Devil's Tower all over the place. He says, yeah, I got one in my living room. You know, what's going on? Well, they round all these people up. A lot of them are the people we saw on the road when Roy first met Jillian and Barry. Throw them into a helicopter. They're going to take them off. And Francois Truffaut is a little hesitant on this. He gets arguing with the big major who is in charge of the military operation there, saying, we shouldn't do this. These people were invited. They all had visions of being here. They don't know why. They put themselves at risk. And the major's like, no, I've got a job to do. You know, this is just coincidence. It's not scientific. You know, I've got a job to do, and I can't let these people screw that all up. You know, they could be subversives, that this or that or that, you know, the whole, you know, again, the Iron Curtain is still in force here. So the Iron Curtain hasn't fallen yet. But Roy realizes this is a put on. You know, they got them all in gas masks sitting in the helicopter. Truffaut's character asks them to wait 5 minutes. He wants to make one more play at the general because he thinks these people should be allowed in on the secret. That clearly, we're going to be meeting the aliens here. But Roy, you know, and Jillian and another guy named Larry escape. They go ahead and they pull their gas masks off. They realize the air, there's nothing wrong with the air, and they go running for the Devil's Tower. Of course, the military is in hot pursuit, and the other people are flown off. And we got a nice little chase scene between the two. Larry doesn't quite make it. the military says, hey, hit them with this nerve toxin, the same one they use to get all the animals to fall asleep. You know, and as the major says, you know, they'll fall asleep for 6 hours and wake up with a hell of a headache, but at least they won't be a problem. But Roy and Jillian manage to escape the military and get over the other side of the Devil's Tower. It's a heck of a climb. You know, I don't think I could have made it. And that's where we see the whole setup. The government's all set up. Actually, it's more than the government. It's the UN to receive these visitors. You know, they got a guy that can play the tone on a big screen and using a series of colors and lights to try to set up a way to communicate with them. And here come the aliens. And Roy and Jillian are watching it, and these, you know, it's very similar to what we saw on the car chase scene. And they come flying in and around, and as we find out, that's just the Vanguard. They're just checking it out, make sure everything's okay. And they communicate back and forth with the folks down there, and then they fly off, and everyone goes, hey, that's great. All right, boy, that was worth it, all that. But it's not over. And while they're all, you know, glad-handing each other and all that stuff, and even Roy and Jillian are getting ready to leak, or she's devastated because she wants to find out where Barry is. That's why she's there. One of the little ones shows back up. He's behind everybody. They don't see it, and it's sort of signaling by lights. It's so subtle. It's wonderful. And then all of a sudden, one of the radar operators go, guys, there's something else there. We've got incoming. And all of a sudden, a flood of UFOs, bigger ones now, coming in. And everyone's going crazy. But there's more yet to come. And every time I see this scene, it blows my mind every single time. Because now we're introduced to the mothership. It's been implied that it's been there all along in a couple of other scenes, but we weren't sure. But now we see it, and it is huge. And it makes an appearance. And, of course, now we've got a situation where the scientists are able to communicate with music, with the big ship. They kick the computers in, and now they're able to get a translation. It's almost like they're Rosetta Stone. So we know that there's going to be future communiques with these people. Now, a couple of little scenes that we've seen along the way. Well, we see, we're talking with the government preparing for this instance. By the way, and this is based on a rumored instance that occurred at, this is the one I was talking about, at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. I made reference to it in the Hangar 18 episode. Where supposedly, you know, we had a meeting with extraterrestrials there back in the 60s. We have seen this group of people, and I mean, they you know, you could tell that they're handpicked, you know, they're G.I. Joes, G.I. Janes, clean jean Marines, you know, the best of the best. They're all dressed in red jumpsuits. They got black sunglasses on. And it's like, hey, maybe we're going to do an exchange. Maybe that's what's going on here. Because when the big ship lands, the doors open up and we start seeing figures coming out. And it's like, okay, now, you know, the first time I saw this, like, now we're going to see what these guys look like. They look a little human. You know, we're just seeing silhouettes because of the light behind them is so bright coming out of the spacecraft. And it's the guys from Flight 19. They haven't aged at all. One of the best lines in the whole movie. Is one of the scientists says, they haven't aged at all since 1945. He says, I guess Einstein was right. And the other guy says, yeah, well, Einstein was probably one of them. I love it. They're just little instances all throughout this movie that give you that little break, which is nice. But all of these people that have been abducted over the years, these people, you know, and I was really psyched watching this. Because I'd read all of the books about the disappearances and stuff like that. And all of a sudden, Jillian looks up. Of course, Dreyfus at this point, Neary says, I've got to go down there. I've just got to go down there. I can't take this anymore. And he runs into Francois Truffaut's character who says, you know, Mr. Neary, why are you here? What do you want? And so they're together. Jillian looks up. And if this doesn't bring a tear to your eye, nothing, you know, you're not human. But you see little Barry walking out of the spaceship. And, of course, Jillian just goes nuts. So she and Barry are together. You know, that her quest, you know, is done. Yeah, the implication that, yeah, one of the reasons she got this image, they were telling her, we will have your son at this place. Yeah, we're returning everybody. Well, as it turns out, Francois Truffaut convinces the government that Roy Neary should go with these others. Because as it turns out, it is a swap. They're going to send all these people with the aliens. And now we meet the aliens. We meet the big alien. This was all done with puppetry, too. I really loved what they did with this. This big, huge alien, and all the little aliens come out. But they're attracted to Roy. I mean, these other people are standing there ready to go. They've been training for months to go on this mission. But the ETs, they want Roy. And so Roy is the one that's hustled into the spacecraft. And in the director's cut and in the original, once Roy's in the ship, it takes off. Now, when the special edition was being advertised, one of the things that a lot of us thought after we saw the original in 77 was, oh, man, wouldn't it have been cool if we could have seen what the inside of that place, that spaceship looked like? And Columbia thought the same thing. And when Spielberg approached him, he said, look, I need some more money. I just want a little more money to reshoot some things and recut this to make it better than what I gave you, because I felt like I was really rushed. They said, we will let you do that. We'll give you $1.5 million to do that. If you'll show us what the inside of the spaceship looks like. So the special edition shows that. And we were all excited. Buddy and I, you know, he was into this film too. And at this time, I'm living in Chapel Hill. I'd gone back to school. I was living in Chapel Hill. And he says, yeah, we got to go see this movie. And I said, you got that right. And we see Roy, you know, what he sees in there. And it's pretty impressive. So that's sort of satisfying that a little bit for me. But as the years wore on, and then when I saw the director's cut, and that scene wasn't in there anymore, but they did put in the full scene of Roy Neary going nuts, because the special edition cut that scene where Roy throwing stuff into his house and all that stuff. They just basically showed Bobby taking off with the kids, and then we see Roy with this big devil's tower in his living room. But they didn't show the whole buildup with him throwing stuff in the kitchen window and all of that. So that scene was put back in, which I was glad. I said, yeah, it was one of the best scenes in the whole movie. But the interior scene was gone. And it was then that I realized, I said, it's a better movie. And Spielberg was quoted as saying down the road, he says, I never should have shown the inside of the spacecraft. It hurts the movie. So he took it out, and rightfully so, because it did hurt the movie. It did. It took some of the mystique off the story. Now, in the special edition, when the mothership flies away to the closing credits, one of the changes was instead of using the music from the movie, it was a rendition of When You Wish Upon a Star, which I thought was really cool. I almost thought they should have left that in the director's cut, but I'll leave it in Spielberg's hand on it, because the soundtrack that John Williams does for this film is just amazing. So the director's cut has the original music ending in it. Folks, I know I've been going on and on and on. This is going to be a little bit of a lengthy episode this week. I cannot say enough about this movie. So much so that I moved it ahead on the schedule of when I was going to do it later on in this season. I've been saving it for a special event, but it's just like, I just couldn't take it anymore. I had to talk about this movie. This is one of the most impactful movies I saw growing up. And as a monster kid, this was, I think, one of the best science fictions I ever saw. Although I have a hard time calling it a science fiction, because, you know, I think there is some truth to this. So, without getting crazy conspiratorial or anything like that. But if you've not seen this movie, and even if you've listened to the show and not seen this movie and I've spoiled everything, go see it. You can find it all over the place on streaming services, and there's a lot of 4K editions of it out there. And I gotta tell you, folks, the 4K version of this is unbelievable. So if you have that capability, it's well worth it. But the HD version is outstanding, too. It's available on Blu-ray, DVD. I would say, you know, get the Blu-ray. And the Blu-ray has a couple of the other editions on there. But not the original. That one's not there. And some a documentary that talks about the making of it. So much went into making this film. That's almost as fascinating as the movie itself. And, you know, I was thinking, you know, in this day of sequels and stuff, you know, I was so glad that Spielberg didn't fall victim to the trap of the 70s and the 80s where everybody had to make a sequel. Because you can't make a sequel to this. But the only storyline that I would have liked to have seen pursued, and I guess it would have to be in like a sequel type thing, but I don't know. And I would love to have known what happened to Bobby and the kids. Her husband just literally falls off the face of the earth. And I would sort of like to know what happened with Jillian and Barry after all this happened. That would make an interesting movie to me. But I don't want anything that would ruin this film, because this film is just, it is one of the top 10 films ever made in my book. An amazing, amazing film from 1977. Of course, now the director's cut, which was finished in the late 1990s. Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Well, folks, I'm amazed my voice held up through this whole thing. I guess I'm going on pure adrenaline here as I get over this head cold. I hope everyone's well out there, and I appreciate your support. We're having a great season. Just having a lot of fun. With all of the stuff that led into this new season, I'm just loving the way the eighth season is starting out. You guys are giving me some great suggestions. Thank you for all the emails and the communications that I get. A lot of your movies are on the list this year. There's a lot of the ones that we've been saving. We hope you have a great week, and we'll be back with you again, as always, on Monday. See you then.
Tune in to The Con Guys Show. Con, as in Comic-Con. We are Hollywood filmmakers and super fans who cover all the news of the con universe, including the films, the TV shows, the streaming series, the experiences, and the events that fuel your fandom. If you'd find it at Comic-Con, then you'll find it here. Now in our seventh year, The Con Guys Show is a proud member of the ESO Network.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.